Quick Bookkeeping. And we're back with another week of the Art of Advisory. We are going to pick up this week where we left off last week, which is this idea of how can a CPA remain independent? By that, we mean objectively independent. In other words, how can they make sure that their opinion is not biased when they're making the choice between either rendering a financial opinion on a business that somebody else is going to use to make a decision, such as maybe a decision to acquire the business or a decision to extend credit to the business, versus being an advisor, where you actually take more of an active role with your customer and become partners in making decisions. I didn't realize this, but on the last episode, when I was talking to Hector, I was basically kind of challenged this idea of why don't accountants and bookkeepers just jump in? I mean, you have the numbers of the business. And he brought up this ethical consideration, which essentially is kind of part of the code, if you will, of accountants and bookkeepers, that you have to make a decision. Do you need to be able to remain independent, or do you want to insert yourself into the business in more of an advisory role? So Hector, with that introduction, just let's kind of go back and why does this exist in the first place? You're on mute, my brother.
We'll go back for a second and talk about what the role of a certified public accountant is. For the most part, a certified public accountant is there to certify that the financial statements that are internally generated or internally produced by a business are fairly stated. So they're free of material errors or free of material misstatement. So in other words, when a certified public accountant who's an outsider of the business comes in and they do certain tests and they kind of look at the balances and look at some documents, sometimes we do an audit, sometimes we don't. We issue a statement saying, hey, in my opinion, this is fairly stated. Now, because of that, outsiders such as investors, bankers, maybe vendors that are going to extend credit to this business will rely upon the information in these financial statements because that financial statement may state that the company is solvent, liquid, has the capacity for repayment. So if you have a certified public accountant that has some sort of financial interest on making sure that this company stays open, then they could be biased in issuing opinions saying, hey, this company is fairly stating their financial statements, therefore they can get the loan, they can get investors, they can get credit, and then the accountant, quote unquote, can get paid their bill. So because of that, accounting standards or ethical standards prevent an accountant from not being 100% independent financially, objectively, in any possible way, if they're going to perform this level of activities or services for a business.
So in our discussion last week, you basically described how this really is a choice that the CPA gets to make, right? You can go to the left or to the right, and one fork is not greater than the other, but it is a conscious choice. So what are some of the factors that you might consider when you're making this choice? Basically, the way I would frame the question is whether you're going to take the fork to become an advisor to the business.
Sure. And, you know, I do have to qualify that a little bit. It's actually technically not a choice. There's sort of this oath, you know, that we take as accountants that we always are going to be independent. Now, It is unpractical to say that every accountant, all 450,000 that are registered with whatever the registry is, that's a number of CPAs are out there, they're all going to be totally independent. There's a large group of body of accountants that are actually employed inside corporations. And therefore, though that group, just by definition, because they get a paycheck from them, they cannot be independent in any possible way. In many ways, the CPAs actually represent the companies, and they're the ones presenting those financial statements. I mean, most large companies have CPAs on staff, if not one or many, that are representing these financial statements, and they're basically either the CFO or they work under the CFO. So somewhere in the middle, there's a group of accountants that actually are neither a what we call an attesting accountant, an accountant that does attest statements, which is giving opinions, or an internal employee. They're sitting somewhere in the middle. A lot of them are preparing financial statements for the management team to sort of make decisions. A lot of them are doing tax returns and that sort of thing. The reality is that if you're going to play in that area, you can't give those opinions on financial statements. And I think the vast majority of accountants want to be there because, you know, you don't want to be tied to the company in any way, shape, or form. And you also don't want to be 100% independent because it doesn't allow you to provide much value. You see, what's interesting is an accountant that does an audit on a financial statement provides an enormous amount of value and at the same time, no value. And let me explain what that means. For a company to have audited financial statements to the outside world that is going to allow them to conduct business, right, to get lines of credit or to get investors, is extremely valuable because that's the lifeblood of the organization, being able to conduct business and getting capital. But at the end of the day, the auditor doesn't really provide much. I mean, all they do is oversee what you did and tell you, yeah, it's right or if it's wrong. In the case, you know, where a potential fraud or collusion or something like that comes up in an audit and the auditor tells the business owner, hey, by the way, you may have collusion inside of the organization. They're stealing from you. There's some value being given there. So if you want to be that type of accountant, great. But if you want to be the one that can actually advise your client, can tell them, hey, I think you should shift your resources from this place to that place. I think you should grow this department. I think you should shut down this department. I think you should probably downsize employees that are doing this. I think you should automate that. Like the minute that you're giving that type of advice, you cease to be independent. So it's technically not a choice, but if you do make the choice, it's sort of a permanent choice. And I think that level of permanent choice is what a lot of accountants get scared of, saying, hey, I'm going to perform one independent act that completely shuts me down from being able to be independent pretty much forever. I mean, you can make the argument that after 5 years, maybe you went from, you know, non-independent to independent, but that's the real choice. So I think that depending on the type of accountant that you want to be, you just can't be both. You're either going to be not independent, you're going to have skin in the game. Hopefully you're charging your client a percentage of the value that you're bringing in or the value you're increasing, or charging them, you know, proportionate to the business growth and all that stuff. But you, bottom line, you can't do both. So that was really what our discussion was taking us down last week.
What's interesting as I'm listening to this, I think about the cliche, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission. And I think how that applies in this context is that for most CPAs, they're working with small business, right? And so, first of all, this is a judgment call whether they cross that line. Not only would it be their judgment, but it would actually have to bring up the case where they're asking for forgiveness, which means somebody's called this into question and a third party's making a judgment call. So I just wonder, if is this much ado about to nothing when you're talking about a smaller business? In other words, are accountants missing out on the opportunity to help their customers to a greater extent by being an advisor, but kind of this ethical consideration, I understand why it exists, but it just seems like it's, for the most part, small business, it's kind of irrelevant because they're privately held companies anyway. Am I off base with that?
No, it's a super interesting topic. So I deal with at least 300 businesses in an annual basis, and we retain in our firm probably about 120, 150 clients, in which we do at least one service per year. And I got to tell you, out of those 150, probably two actually needed a financial audit. Now, what's interesting is you become a CPA because you want to have, or you want to exercise, you know, that, let's call it, power that's given upon you without license, the power to opine on a financial statement. And when you don't have that power, you really don't do much with your license, which is kind of interesting that the vast majority of accountants are not doing audit, but they can. That's what they got licensed for in the first place. They're not doing audit because they're dealing with the type of companies that don't need one in the first place, or the ones that say, sure, I would love to have one, but they can't pay $25,000 or whatever it costs. So what's really interesting is the vast majority of us are working with small business clients that are probably never going to need an audit or a reviewed financial statement. So there's no need to have an independent accountant. And by the way, if you play the numbers sort of like lottery, you know, if you have 100 clients and two are potential audits, and yes, okay, you missed out on a $25,000 per client invoice, I think you can still get the $25,000 by doing advisory services if you are providing enough value where the client is being more profitable and therefore giving you a piece of that. So I just think it's sort of a moot strategy that most accountants take, which is, hey, I want to remain independent so I can provide that amazing service, amazing power that I have with my license, which is to opine financial statements. But I think, in my opinion, on the type of work that I do, I just don't see how I can add ultimate value that way, even though it's the highest ticket price service that most accountants can give, what's called assurance services. But you know, there are so many firms that do that. I think you're better off partnering with other independent accounting firms that will do that work, and then you focus on the year-long audio valuing services all year and forget about independence. But it's really up to you, depending on the type of practice you want to run.
Well, I think you just nailed it, right? I think there's so much more opportunity available by being an advisor, and the number of your customers that will actually need the financial independence piece, as you called it, assurance, is so small that you might as well just partner with somebody to do that. I mean, for example, I interviewed an accountant a year ago on my show who doesn't do tax work. He actually refers that out to another CPA. So it's the same idea. So if I can kind of paraphrase what you just said, I think you basically said, you know what, focus on the advisory work because that's where you can help the most. And as you and I know, that's where I think, quite frankly, the most financial return to your business is going to come from as well. So have we just put this to bed? Did we just kind of say, you know what, find somebody else to do it for your customer when you need it, move on and be an advisor and don't worry about it? Is that a good summary?
I would say so. I think if you're strictly an auditor and you're watching this podcast or listening to this podcast, you know, you're welcome to do so. but I think that a lot of these discussions we're going to have are going to break independence. I think independence is going to be just something that you're going to have to completely smash. And you almost, and again, the other fear that I think accountants have is that, unfortunately, because, you know, we're licensed to be responsible and our teachings are conservative, if something goes down, like something really bad with a company goes down, some lawsuit, you know, having to do with the numbers, with financial misrepresentation or something like that, the less independent you are, the more in the hook, let's call it that, you're going to be. The more you're going to be inquired about, the more often you can be called to court. Like, for example, I had a client that 7 years ago, I prepared their personal and corporate financial statements. And, you know, I'm not independent because I prepared their tax returns as well. I give them advice. I talk to their bookkeeper all year long for 2 years straight. So I'm not independent in any way, shape, or form. So my client got divorced. I mean, the individual, right? I mean, I did company and personal, but the individual person got divorced. And then the ex-wife now thought, you know, that they were hiding money. I mean, the gentleman lived a really sort of weird lifestyle, like a rich and famous lifestyle, where their financial statements didn't say so. Now, I really don't know how that happened, but hey, you know, I wasn't auditing his financial statements. I had, you know, bank statements, credit cards. I had all that stuff, and everything that was prepared, I'm prepared to defend. But, you know, he's being sued by his wife because he says, I don't believe that the numbers you're presenting to court is what you're actually making, just because you're driving this expensive car and spending money in a nightclub or whatever it was whatever was also sort of part of what caused the divorce in the first place. But I had to testify in court, right? There was no way I could say, hey, I'm independent, I can't do it. I had to testify in court. I become a material witness because I was involved with the person's corporate books for 2 years. So I think that a lot of accountants like myself don't want to go through that because I spent 20, 30 hours dealing with this case. And now I'm still trying to bill my client for that time because I couldn't value price that, right? You know, so that's something I'm trying to bill the client for. And the client's like, well, I'm not going to pay you. I never agreed that you would charge me for, you know, appearing in court. I'm like, well, how am I supposed to charge my time? So one of the things that's kind of interesting about it is if you are involved in a very deep way with your client, it is likely that you're not necessarily going to be responsible for it. If you do ethical stuff for the most part and you cover, you know, CYA for the most part, I don't think you're going to be in the hook, but you may be a material witness no matter what. And your answers are very powerful because you're supposed to be held to a higher standard. So one of my lessons that I learned from that is, you know, hey, listen, because I'm going to be not independent, I am technically in the hook for anything that can happen in the future. And this is all what they call tail insurance. Like, this is something that we don't know what's going to happen because it can happen 2, 3, 4, 5 years later. So if you're going to work very closely with your client as an advisor, I think you almost have to price as such. So you have to take it from, what do they call the insurance people that do the life insurance calculation?
Actuaries.
The actuary. So you almost have to take an actuarial approach to these type of clients. And if we're dealing with a client that's a high risk client, a client that's dealing maybe with an industry that, you know, that's very propense to get sued, you know, like, let's say, for example, a landscaping industry that tends to hire people that are not necessarily 100% legal, let's call it that, and they're propense to get a lawsuit or by the Department of Labor or something like that, and you're working with their books all year long, plus you're giving them advice, you know, it is likely that you're going to be exposed to some information that could, let's not call it incriminate, but it could get the client in trouble. And if something goes down, you are probably going to be a material witness for that. So you almost have to price the risk on your advisory engagements to make sure to keep in mind that the minute you break independence, you could be involved in other things that you didn't want to. And I tell you, I think that all of us collectively, or most of us, we fear that. We don't want that. Okay. We don't want to deal with the tail end. We don't like the uncertainty. And if it's not going to let you sleep at night, then don't do it. But if you want to provide value to your client, just keep in mind that this is a normal part of doing business. And there's no such thing as, you know, a bad risk. There's just a bad premium, right? So you anything could be risky, but if you charge enough for it and you save it, you know, you will have, like I said, I couldn't bill my client for it, but if I charged enough, you know, let's say an extra 20% to all these high risk clients, and I took that pool of money and put it, let's call it, in my high risk savings account, once it comes time for me to spend 20, 30 hours dealing with a court case, for example, I could pull from that account and say, well, it's not that I'm losing on it. I basically charged for it beforehand and now I'm drawing upon it. So a lot of our business can learn from the insurance companies or insurance practices.
One thing you said that caught my attention is that essentially the moment you do somebody's tax return, you're giving up independence. Is that a correct statement or did I misinterpret what you said?
So the rules of the AICPA actually do not say that if you prepare the tax return, you lose independence. That the tax return itself is not. However, a tax return typically involves tax planning, which involves making a decision such as, let's buy this property this year or next year. Let's lease this car or let's purchase this car. And the minute you are involved in the decision making, that's where you lose independence. So it's funny, the tax return itself does not, but the work that most competent tax preparers do with a client does.
So I'm going to stand by my statement based on that the moment you prepare a tax return, you lose independence, because I don't see how you can do somebody's tax return without doing tax planning. I mean, if you do, then in my opinion, you're committing, you know, CPA malpractice, right? because isn't the whole purpose of a CPA to kind of, to not to kind of, to help the client build wealth? And how do you prepare a tax return without providing tax advice? I don't know. Is it, am I just, you know, I'm not a CPA, but that's my layman's opinion.
Not necessarily. So ideally speaking, I would say if you retain a CPA and if you're working with a client that wants the true full service, is we do tax planning year round. The problem is a lot of times these clients don't come for that. Okay, I'll give you an example. Let's say, I'm just going to throw an example out there. Let's say we have this amazing world-renowned nutritionist that also becomes a chef and opens a restaurant, right? And people go to that restaurant because they're going to buy highly nutritious food. And they walk in, they order food, they eat, and they leave. If you don't hire that nutritionist to help you figure out whether you ate the right thing, you can't, you know, conflate, you know, nutrition with that one meal. At the same time, it happens with tax services. Sometimes it's hard to conflate client walking in saying, do my taxes after the fact with, you know, them hiring us a year ahead of time and saying, let's work every month or every quarter to take a look at where we are and make decisions together about how we're going to present our financial statements and how we're going to plan for tax. So not necessarily my practice. Sometimes the clients don't give us that choice, right? They just walk in and saying, do my taxes. Now, oddly enough, there are tax preparers that say, I don't do that work, get out, right? You know, or I'll do it next, you know, work with your last accountant for last year. I'll do it next year if we start planning from the get-go. So a lot of us, you know, sort of fear of missing a client or missing an opportunity, will take the work and then we end up just almost always setting the expectation that that's how we function with our clients. They just walk in at the end of the year and say, do my taxes. So sometimes it takes a little bit of us, of the tax preparer, discipline to tell the client, look, I'll do it, but starting next year or starting this year, we're going to work differently. We're going to plan, we're going to do things monthly or quarterly. And then what you said, if we don't give the client that choice and we allow the client year over year to just do that, then that could be quote unquote CPA malpractice. But it's not necessarily the case. A lot of us, that's how we work. I mean, the client just tells us, here we go. And then we have a small time period, you know, during tax season to do the whole thing. Ideally, if we do our work, if we plan correctly, there wouldn't be such a thing as tax season. Like the whole year would be tax season, right? Because we're basically planning ahead. And then January 2nd, I have a client that literally hires me for that. And on January 2nd, they're like, is my tax return done? And they can get it done because we did all the work. Literally on December 29th, we were sitting there looking at their books, making sure that even the decisions they made between the 29th, the 30th, and the 31st affected the tax year. But those are clients that pay for that and they want that service. But it's really, I think it's up to the accountant to say, this is how it works, period. I mean, you almost have to draw the line in some cases. I mean, there's cases of cases, Kirk. So sometimes it is, sometimes it's not.
So one of the things that is important to me in these sessions that we record is that we make it applicable. So I'm going to just offer kind of some of the three or four guidelines that I think we could offer our audience. Then I'll kind of want to dive on into this because, to be honest, when we brought this up at the end of last week's show, I thought, oh my gosh, this is a huge thing and we got to tackle it. And I guess it's important, but it's not as big an issue as I thought. So number one, I would say to our friends, their accountants and bookkeepers, is don't sweat it. Provide the services that your customers are asking for, because most of them are small businesses and this is never going to come up. Second, and I know you said this is not a hard and fast rule, but I think it's a good guideline, is just the fact that, you know what, if you're doing their tax return, you're already close to that line, if not over anyway. So why not go ahead and step into the advisory role? And I think that brings us what I would say would be a third guideline is that you actually create more value in the advisory area than you do in the financial audit area, both to the customer and to yourself if you're pricing it right. Would you agree with those three guidelines? I mean, can we sum it up with those three things? I mean, obviously they're guidelines. We're not saying they're rules that can't be broken. There's always exceptions. But I think those three things probably apply to the 80% plus set of cases.
So I agree on that. Actually, I've I, in some way, shape, or form, I live by those guidelines.
All right. So anything else you'd say about this topic? I mean, if we put this thing to rest, I know we've defined it well, and, you know, I've kind of challenged you with some questions, and I think you've done a good job of, you know, handling those baseballs that I'm throwing at you. But is there anything else we need to add on this topic, or have we really kind of
fell apart? I think we're good. Maybe we could turn. I'll turn this back around to you. You know, you have your own account. You run your own business. You have your own accountant. I know in the past couple of years that you've been speaking more to an accounting group. Maybe your perception of, you know, what an accountant does, what they could do, their potential. I think all that stuff has probably shifted. But I would love to ask you, you know, I would say go back a couple of years. What type of relationship, you know, were you expecting to have from your accountant when you first hired him or her? You know, were you looking for an independent, objective type of relationship, or were you looking for a skin in the game, understand my business, feel my pain type of relationship before you hired him or her? And then as your business progressed, how that perception changed?
It's a great question. The first thing that went through my mind as you were wording that is, it never occurred to me whether I cared whether my accountant was financially independent or not. That was the first thing that occurred to me. So it doesn't enter your customer's mind. And that's both a plus and a minus, right? So it just means that I'm seeking an accountant because I have something that I need to achieve, and I'm reaching out to them to help me achieve that. Now, that puts the responsibility on the accountant that if this is one of those exceptions, you know, a bigger company, a company that might go public, somebody who has accumulated, you know, a few million dollars in wealth or whatever, then I need to advise them, you know, potentially, or make a decision internally about, do I remain financially independent or become an advisor? But as a customer, that never entered my mind. So that's the first thing I would say. I think that's significant. Second, when I reached out to accountant, it started with, I need to get my tax return done. And I think for a lot of people, and so for me, I was small, my business, I was literally either a solo practice or maybe three people, something like that, real small. And so it was just, I need to get the tax return done. And I can't remember, it might have been after that magic date in April, right? So the first thing I was is like, hey, how do I file an extension, or can I get one? You know, my homework's late. What do I do? Can I, you know, is there some way I can get partial credit from the teacher? I think that was kind of that tax work thing. The third point is just, as a small business, I don't think it entered my mind that my accountant could have such an impact on me in a different way. I've actually learned by associating with accountants and speaking to accountants how much of a greater impact they can have. And it's interesting when I find accountants who actually do step into that advisory role, and I see how they're impacting their business. And then I talk to other accountants who are hesitant to speak into that. And it just amazes me that there would be any hesitation, because there's such value you can bring. And that's one of the reasons I want to talk about this topic, is because I want to help our friends overcome whatever those objections are internally to being the advisor. So I'd say those three things. Number one, it never occurred to me they need to be independent. Number two, I just wanted my tax return. And number three, it didn't occur to me how much they could help.
I want to unpack something real quick, because I think something you said was very significant. And you said, I think that's significant. You said, when I walked into starting to work with that accountant, I was looking to just get a transaction done. And you're a value guy. I mean, Kirk, you've been preaching value forever. And you know that anyone that's in the professional services division or industry has the opportunity to provide an immense amount of value. You know, when your clients came to you saying, hey, I need a database, or I need you to design a program for me that, you know, that inputs this information and outputs this information, you never really looked at it as a transaction, or at least you evolved into, hey, you know, am I here to clerk that request, or am I here to understand what they need, and potentially a hybrid between what they're asking me for and what I can offer? So you even walked into your accountant not even with that mentality. So that makes it even more interesting that the vast majority of small business owners are probably looking at accounting as this big nuance, I mean, or nuisance, nuance or nuisance, one of those two. Kirk, I'll allow you to correct me when I'm wrong on that. So they see it as this sort of like this obligation. I got to go talk to this guy or gal that's going to solve this problem or help me be compliant. And that's sort of a big word in our world, is we're there to make people compliant. And compliance, it has really little value. Compliance is, you know, settling for what the man is asking you to do, right? Compliant is what the teacher tells you to do something, and then you ask why, and you say, just do it, don't ask why. That's compliance. And I think a lot of us taxpayers, we don't question a lot what we have to do. We just go to the person that we hope and trust to get us compliant. We hope that they pay us, they charge us an amount that we can afford, and then we just trust that person to tell us what the number is, and we pay it, and that's it. And the accountants have a significant role they can play on whether or not to be compliant about this behavior or to change it from within. And it's almost our sort of our sworn duty to ourselves, not to the old accounting industry, to the new accounting industry that we need to reshape. We need to do it in such a way that we're adding value. People see us as value generators and not as compliant makers. Because as technology and computerized systems and AI flourishes, and as the government has more and more of this, like I think the government hopefully gets smarter and builds AI and technology and automation into their systems. I mean, that's a really big dream. But if the government does this, they're going to be able to have this sort of direct government-to-person compliance system, and the person is not going to feel that they have to work with an intermediary anymore. So once you're no longer that compliance intermediary, which is that requirement that you had, that compliance requirement, what are we going to do? We don't need to do data entry anymore because software like QuickBooks and stuff gets the stuff from the bank. We don't need to do tax returns anymore because the government starts, you know, automating some of these things. And even with the 2018 tax reform, which, you know, we could leave those details to a different episode, they simplified the tax code a little bit. So a lot of taxpayers don't need to use a tax preparer. So little by little, our industry that was solely based on our knowledge of compliance is going to become less and less valuable. And what are we going to do, right? So if we don't, from within, you know, make it our sworn duty to our industry, to the longevity of our industry, to change that perception and to take those opportunities when the client walks in dragging their feet saying, do my tax return, to say, hey, the tax return is the outcome of what I do. What I do is not tax returns. Tax return is one of the little byproducts of what we do. So if we don't do it ourselves, the client's not going to do it for us. I don't think the clients are out there in a coalition to make sure their accountants add value to them. I don't think anyone's out there forcing the accountants to add value to them, or am I wrong about that? So it's going to have, I think it's going to have to be us who do that. And we do that through the spirit and the ethos of advisory services, I believe.
It's interesting. I think the word compliance has had so much impact on certain industries, and obviously accounting is a huge one. You know, you said something in there about, I can't remember your exact words, but essentially the waiting on the government to do something good, that's a long way. You know, Ronald Reagan said, you know, the worst words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Okay. The government, you know, they're not a for-profit entity. And in my opinion, you know, if we treated the government like a for-profit entity and we as the public shareholders held them accountable for the profit we get, the value we get out of it, I think that'd be a whole nother thing. But I want to drive home the fact that because compliance comes from government, basing your business on that is basing your business on something that is outside your control, right? Nobody knew up till the last few days whether this tax reform was going to get passed. And you're right, that is a topic for another show. But my point is, do you want to base your business on something that is government driven, i.e. something out of your control, i.e. something that is not motivated by a profit motive, which I think is a healthy motive. I think profit motive incentivizes people for the most part toward doing good and serving others? Or do you want to base your business on something that you can actually control? I think compliance, you're basically helping your customer comply. That's no fun for them, and it's not much fun for you, because I've talked to a bunch of accountants who hate doing tax returns, right? It's not necessarily the most fun thing. But what we're talking about is actually doing what I think accountants, what they're put on this earth to do. It is to help their customers see insights from their numbers that they can't see. Why can't they see it? Because they're not accountants. Accountants have a certain perspective into a business that they are granted by their training, by their experience, by their understanding of numbers and how working with multiple businesses, that experience gives them that additional insight. And tax returns has nothing to do with that. It might a little, okay? Yeah, you help a business pick the right corporate structure, right? Or you help a business make changes when these tax reform laws come about. But it's not like we get these huge reform laws every year. Yes, it seems like every year we'll wait until the last minute to see, okay, are they going to, you know, re-up the, you know, the 197 deduction or whatever, where you can take, you know, buy a car and take a big, you know, hunk of it in depreciation, whatever. But the bottom line is, for the most part, we are going to make more substantial impact on our customers through that numbers looking and telling them and helping them understand and then make decisions based from it.
Right. I think we can split the accounting industry in three, right? And then we're going to pick which area we want to be in. We can be, two of the three are compliance, right? So we have third-party financial statement presentation or attestation, which we spoke about earlier, audit. We have the second, which is tax returns, which is an obligation by our federal, state, and local governments. And the third is none of those two, which is help your client do what they sought out to do when they started their business in the first place. And I think that some accountants, I think they're called to the profession, like, you know, just like certain doctors are called to the profession. But for the most part, I think when you're in college or high school, and you're making a choice, hey, I want to be an accountant, we probably do it because, hey, we're good at numbers and we've seen other accountants not necessarily be wealthy, but have good enough jobs to be. And I think most of us like get into that profession because of that, because we're like, look, we're probably going to be successful as accountants. But the one thing that we forget is when you are not just an accountant, but you are in the public accounting services industry, which for the most part, you would be an entrepreneur yourself, or you would be a small business owner yourself. The real reason why you're working for yourself and obviously helping your clients is because you want to build wealth, you want to be independent, you want to make choices that help your family, and you want to make choices that go alongside your values. And that is the same thing that most entrepreneurs do, right? They start a business because they want to be financially independent. They want to build wealth. They want to have, you know, also independence from, you know, working in a job. So the reasons why people go into entrepreneurship, which are clients, and in most of us, independent accountants that do the work for them, they match. And I think that if you want to be part of that third category that adds value, you probably want to figure out a way to take the passion you have for your own business growth and bring it to the table when helping your clients, and stop thinking about the taxes and the compliance and the independent financial statements. Think about what the client is trying to achieve, you know, change customers' lives, you know, change the marketplace, create innovative products, solve problems. So if you actually align yourself with that business owner and get deep in your head, what is it that they're trying to achieve? And you try to think alongside with them and use your accounting skills, use your compliance skills, you know, use your, even your independence, objectiveness that is taught, you know, in your core schooling. If you use that alongside the same passion you have with your business owner, you can provide much more value than what you think. And I think most of my colleagues that don't do advisory services, that's what they fail to see. They fail to see that they can, in fact, add value. And when you tell them, hey, provide advisory services, their common response is, well, I don't know how to. Well, the problem is You can't find that in a book. You can't find that in a, you know, in a video somewhere. You can't find that in a podcast. You know, that comes from within. That comes from their heart. But what, you know, Kirk and I are trying to do is we're trying to give you as many relatable stories as possible to realize that advisory is just you speaking from the heart, you giving your opinion from the heart, while at the same time maintaining the great core elements that accounting training has, such as balancing financial statements, being independent, et cetera, et cetera.
There was something you said there that I was going to comment on, and then it just went poof. And so I'm found in one of those rare instances where I don't necessarily know the next thing I'm going to say. Oh, I remember. So the three groups, right? It occurs to me that, and the three groups I'm talking about are basically the three categories that you kind of put accountants into, okay? Financial auditors, people who focus on compliance, i.e. taxes, payroll taxes, et cetera, tax returns, and then third, advisory, right? Well, from our discussion, what I've gleaned is on the first one, the financial auditing, that's really a conscious choice. You really need to decide that's where I'm going to go and specialize in that. Second, this compliance area is really an area you don't want to be. Number one, it's an area you don't want to be because you don't like it anyway. And this third area, the area of advisory, is where there's the most opportunity, but yet it's everybody's hanging out in the compliance pool because they're scared to dip the toe in the water of the advisory pool. Now, I'm sure we could make the same analogy in other industries, legal, software, et cetera. So I don't want it to sound like I'm just picking on accountants, but I just, most of the accountants I talk to don't want to be in the first two buckets. And yet they're scared to dip their toe in the third. But the third is where the most money is. It's where the most impact is. And I love how you put it. You said, take the very things you want to do in your own business as the owner of a small CPA bookkeeping practice and do those for your customers. You agree with that?
Yes, at least that's where the passion should come from. Because it's possible that your client is in the manufacturing industry and it's hard for you to connect, you know, your small business service, your small business B2B type services with someone that manufactures. Like I would sympathize with, hey, it's difficult to make a direct connection between what you do and how you do it with how the client does it. But I think the spirit of the advisory comes from that same reason that you as an entrepreneur would be kept up at night for, you know, can I make payroll? You know, am I marketing? Am I spending the right money in marketing? Am I spending the right amount of activities in developing my business? Am I spending too much time on social media? I don't know. those things that we're sort of not sure about. You know, like running a business in a modern area, it's hard for someone that's been in business for 20, 25 years because you know they were told that if you're listed in the phone book and you send postcards, and you send Christmas gifts, you know, you're going to have a good, successful business. In today's world, you know, you have to have a Facebook page, you have to have Facebook ads, you have to post daily videos in Instagram, you have to send electronic Starbucks gift cards to your customers. I mean, the essence of business hasn't changed. You know, like, you have to market yourself, you have to be valuable, you have to reward your clients for good behavior, but the how certainly has changed. Or the mechanics have changed. And I think anyone that's an entrepreneur, I think 100 years ago, 200 years ago, now, and 50 years ago, probably worries about the same things. It just looks different. So like my advice to anyone that's afraid of giving advisory to a business because they think that maybe they can add value, I would say not true. It's just, you're seeing it different because the mechanics look different. The, you know, the hows may look different, but I'm telling you at the end of the day, the whys are all the same.
One thing just occurred to me, you know, what did accountants do before the US decided to have an income tax, which was right. What, the 20s, the 1910s, something like that. I mean, I know it was, you know, last century, right?
I think it was 1914, I believe was like the first year they had income tax. You know,
so are we basically asking accountants to go back 100 years and do what accountants, quote, did in the 1800s? I mean, is that a totally absurd way to summarize our conversation, or does it fit?
It does fit a little bit. I think the problem with accounting is that it's tedious. And I think that small business owners don't get into entrepreneurship for the glamour of accounting, right? Like that's one piece of their business that, even if it's not a compliance issue, you do need to know where your money is, where your money's coming from, who owes you, how much inventory you have. That is, it's a necessity. Even if there was no government and there was no financial audits, every small business owner needs to know where they are so they can make, you know, the right decisions. But it's not just making the right decisions. It's having the capacity to forget about it. I think that we as accountants, we forget that the true value that we bring to the table is giving someone the ability to not to feel their brain on preoccupied with things that do not have to do with numbers. And if we can achieve that, that is the ultimate value we can give. So for us to take over the worries of the numbers, and in some cases the interpretation of the numbers, going back to the last episode where you say it's weird that accountants and bookkeepers don't utilize those numbers as a catalyst to provide advisory. It is weird. It actually is extremely weird that we don't do it that often. So the, you know, advisory would possibly come in three steps. You know, step number one, we take away all the worries about numbers being accurate. So that's one great piece of value that we can add. And we probably already do that. So I'm pretty sure you would agree with that. Step two is we ask permission to do something a little bit above and beyond that. Kirk, well, let's before we go into details, what do you think about that piece?
About asking permission?
No, right before that, you know, doing the first step. First step is for us to take away the worries about the numbers from our clients.
Certainly. Now, I think the only thing I would add is that I think there's a business has to be at a certain level. I don't want to say a certain size or certain dollar volume, because it would vary, but there are certain traits, I think, that would apply to a business where an owner is ready to step away from the numbers or should be stepping away from the numbers. It's kind of that delegation kind of thing. I think when you're a small solo business, you kind of still need to have those real close, right? So a business is going to grow. Now, that doesn't mean as an accountant, by helping them grow, you help them do that. But that's just kind of a side thought there. But yes, ideally, you want to take over the things that you're an expert in so they can focus on what they're an expert in. And trust me, they're not an expert in reading their financial numbers, most business owners. They're not an expert in knowing how to apply the new tax regs to make sure they're getting the best tax savings, et cetera. I think that applies.
So that would be step one, Kirk. So then we're in agreement. Step one is we get to the point where they only inquire about the number in high level summary ways. Okay. You know, am I up? Am I down? You know, almost like green light, red light, right? So should I keep doing this? Should I stop doing this? That would be the first layer of value that we give. And I think most accountants do that, even if they don't want, if they don't think they do, that's what they do. Like they take away that worry. So that's step number one. Step number two is we say, hey, can we evolve from this engagement into a different one where maybe we make decisions with you, right? Not for you, with you, right? So we take these numbers, we help you interpret them, and then we look for patterns together. Or maybe let's discuss your strategy. What are you thinking in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years? Where is your business going to go? And how that aligns with what the numbers are telling us. Is it realistic? You know, are you planning correctly? You know, you're saying you're going to grow double in the next couple of years. Well, have you thought about staffing? Because there will be a direct relationship between you having the staff to fulfill the work and your growth in customers and sales. Well, let's take a look at let's see what that would look like. And then you start doing what we called forecasting, projections, business planning. So that would be first two. So first one, get them compliant, get them to not worry about the numbers, you know, get the government off the back, no penalties. That's level one. Level two, hey, can we help you? Can we make decisions with you? Can we plan together? And then level three, which is sort of the top of everything. Level three is, hey, let's align ourselves with your growth. And let's add value where the return on what we bring is profitability. The return of what we bring is higher revenues. The return of what we bring is money saved into your retirement account. The return of what we bring is wealth building and having your business be worth more so you can sell it or groom your business for your kids to take over, or you know, some sort of succession planning. So that level three level of service is very much tied to pricing, because at that point we are no longer, you know, kind of there. We are running alongside of them. And when they stumble, we're going to stumble and we're going to take a hit, but then we're going to pick them back up and then help them continue. So that's a much higher level of service, which is the same level of service you would have with a business partner, right? If you have a business partner and that business partner is going through struggles, you're going to feel the pain. If you're going through struggles, they're going to feel the pain. Just like a marriage, same thing. But what ends up happening is when you work at that level, you know, the netting effect of one area being hurt and the other area being strong tends to keep the entire relationship afloat. And that would be like the level three level of service. So the minute you go from that level one to level two, you break independence, right? And that's the interesting piece about this is, you know, are you ready for that? Or can you make yourself ready for that? Or can you figure out a way to communicate with your client that is the most value you can bring to them?
It's interesting that you said step one is just getting them compliant. Unfortunately, a lot of our colleagues, they just stay there, right? They just get there and they think, okay, now I've got them compliant. Now all my job is to keep them compliant. And what we're saying is no, there is more territory. We're saying go west, young man. Go after that territory that you're currently, you know, not even venturing into. And I think that's what we're really challenging our colleagues to do. So we're kind of getting toward the top of the hour. As we wrap it up, I want to throw out a couple of ideas for future topics. And so we're not making any guarantee that we're going to get to these, but I think they might be some good possible ideas. Number one, I think it'd be fun to kind of do a show based around what did an accountant do before the income tax law in the U.S. was passed in 1914. If that has any weight to it, that would be fun. It requires some research. And then second, I get this out of a thread in the Verisage group. What are the advisory opportunities that are coming out of the new tax reform law? What are the opportunities, you know, instead of looking at it from a glass half empty, oh shoot, how do we, you know, hurry up and make changes to, you know, be in compliance again? No. What are the opportunities? How has this opened up new marketing opportunities, new ways of advising clients? Either of those strike your fancy for the next show, maybe?
Yeah, those are perfect. Those are perfect. I think one more would be, what if you did everything you needed to do on the 2018 tax laws, right? So we put our client in the position to squeeze every single piece of that legislation, and what comes next even after that. I think I love the three, you know, like what happened in the past, what needs to happen in the present, and what stuff needs to happen moving forward. I think those are great topics. And we'll also welcome the folks that follow us on Facebook to add some topics related to that. I mean, we want to really make this, this chat not about Kirk and Hector's experiences. We're going to bring in some guests, but we also would love to hear from you. What are your challenges with advising your clients or transforming your practice to advisory? Those comments in Facebook would be great. So if you're listening to this in the podcast version, just go to facebook.com/artofadvisory and you can add some comments there.
All right, Hector. See you next week.
All right. See you next week, Kirk.
Bye.